You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
From the rolling bluffs of the Driftless region to the pristine shorelines of Superior in Michigan, from the Northwoods to the Kettle Moraine, Civic Media broadcasts across all of Wisconsin. For all of Wisconsin. Take a trip with us across the radio network to hear from communities throughout the state. This is the Civic Media Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to the second hour of the Civic Media Spotlight. We begin with Rational Revolution with Mark Becker. Mark speaks with Goff Cabot Service, Vice President at the Niskanen Center. He's an expert on the Middle East and gives us an update on the relevant war.
What's going on, everybody?
You're in the right place.
Yes, this is the Rational Revolution. I am so glad that you're here. Every week here on Civic Media Radio Network, you've got me, Mark Becker, and you've got a returning guest who pivoted better than LeBron James did to come and hang out with us today. I asked him late yesterday, hey, do you know anyone? Would you be able to? Because man, we gotta sort out what's going in Iran. And there's nobody better to do it than your friend and mine, Jeff Cabaservice from the Niskanen Center. What's up, buddy? Welcome back.
Hey, good to be with you again.
Yeah, I'm so glad that you're here. Your travels have looked amazing, by the way. You know, dude's been everywhere in the world. And yeah. But Iran, what is happening there?
That's a darn good question. I mean, you know, on the one hand, we are talking in a moment when things are unsettled. There's been this two-week truce declared. It's not quite clear if all sides are adhering to the truce as yet. There's been a 10-point plan put forward by Iran, a 15-point plan put forward by us. It's unclear if serious negotiation is going on regarding these points or what will result at the end of it all. And we're also just not being told a lot about what goes on, and there isn't good reporting on the scene for perhaps obvious reasons. Nonetheless, it's looking a lot like the whole conflict has been a case of operational excellence on the part of our military and strategic incoherence on the part of the administration. And I suspect the peace will pretty closely resemble the war in that regard.
Like, how did we get to this point?
Well, you know, you could go all the way back to the 1953 CIA coup that overthrew the Iranian leader Mossadegh. But I think, you know, more generally, we got here because Donald Trump got reelected to a second term. And he said that he was not going to be constrained by the old Republican establishment. And indeed, he has only had around him yes men and sycophants. Yeah. And I suspect, you know, without any actual demonstrated documentary evidence of this, that when it was time to think about what the United States should do vis-a-vis Iran, that his enablers like Pete Hegseth said to him things like, Mr. President, you've shown that you don't need to listen to experts, these military people who war gamed out the whole Straits of Hormuz situation 10,000 times. You don't need to listen to the statesmen who talk about prudence. You've just shown that you can just do things. If you want to go in and take Iran, then you can take it. And the hell with expert advice. And that's largely why we're here.
And, you know, like I look at it. Yes. I mean, the military is brilliant and overwhelming and, you know, with incredible precision. So like, that's awesome. But seeing the rollout and this looks like a ready, shoot, aim type thing. It doesn't look like there's a lot of thought into what happened.
Well, I think, you know, again, there were assumptions that proved to be incorrect that were baked into this whole adventure. The assumption number one was that the regime would collapse. Yeah. Well, that didn't happen. Or that the Iranian people would rise up against what they correctly regard as an evil and oppressive regime. That also didn't happen. I think the assumption was that if you decapitated Iran's top leadership, then what remained would be incoherent. Maybe they too would run for the exits. Maybe they would be more moderate than their predecessors. That hasn't happened. Trump assumed that Iran would not strike out at the neighboring Gulf countries. That hasn't happened. And I think Hegseth and Trump.
All right. We lost you. We're back. You were talking about how we thought that Iran was going to leave the Straits of Hormuz open. They would be open. And then we had a glitch and we are back. So continue that thought. Sorry about that.
Yeah, sorry. I think it's probably on my end. I think the idea of putting military troops in the numbers needed to take over the country was never on the table. Right. And so Trump gambled and he lost, basically. And now Iran is, you know, in some ways degraded militarily. Some of their has been taken out. But nonetheless, you know, they have now actually in some ways more leverage than before, given that they have decided that they are not going to allow the Strait of Hormuz to be international waters. They're going to control it. They're going to charge people to go through it. And they're going to not allow unfriendly powers to go through it. In some ways, they actually emerge from this in a stronger position than they did before the war.
Right. And so if you'd like, because we have time and there's a history lesson from someone, you know, like yourself that knows the history, do you mind, like, how an abridged version of when all of this started? I know there's the 57, there's so much, but leading us to where we are today.
Potted history is that Iran has always been a distinct, proud, distinguished civilization. Iran are Persians. They are not Arabs. The Shia religion is not quite the same thing as the Sunni version of Islam that's practiced in most of the surrounding countries. There's been a distinctive element to that. The United States has meddled in Iran, as we did in 1953, when it seemed like they were moving in the direction of socialism and anti-colonialism too much for the liking of some of the people around Dwight Eisenhower. And we also overly invested in propping up the Shah of Iran, despite what was evidently an unpopular and repressive regime. Of course, there was the whole history of our hostage crisis in Iran and the Ayatollah Khomeini and the bad relations that we got off from the start. No U.S. administration since then has really found the right footing vis-a-vis Iran. We have alternately threatened and appeased them and never found the right balance. Iran, for its part, has maintained a pretty consistent view of death to America and death to Israel. They have never softened in their view of the United States, and there has never really been what would properly be regarded as a moderate administration or regime in power there. And it's a tragedy because, again, the Iranian people are among one of the proudest and most talented cultures and civilizations on Earth. They deserve better.
Yeah, right. to all of that, you know, we're talking with Jeff Kapasovers from the Niskanen Center. The Niskanen Center is a think tank in Washington, D.C. that advocates for market-oriented principles with environmentalism, immigration reform, civil liberties. And they're just brilliant when it comes to history, just like our guy here. So we're talking about, you know, the history about it. You said that Iran is in a arguably a stronger position than they were when this whole thing started. Talk about that.
So Iran has largely unfriendly relations with its neighbors, but it's also one of the major powers in that area. It is also utterly ruthless. It fought a long war with Iraq under Saddam Hussein, in which they proved completely willing to put child soldiers forward to clear landmines and the like.
Oh my God.
They are situated in a way that gives them a controlling position over the Strait of Hormuz, which is one of the choke points of the world's global economy. Not much of the oil that goes to the United States goes through the Gulf of the Strait of Hormuz, but a lot of what goes to Asia and Europe does go through that critical choke point. And so does a lot of the world's fertilizer. So the United States, without consulting any of its allies before it decided to undertake this adventure in Iran, has caused enormous economic difficulties for them, but also put in question its own legitimacy as the guarantor of the post-World War II global trading order. Because now it's been shown that a country like Iran can, if it so chooses, disregard the principle that the Strait of Hormuz is international waters. It can effectively blockade that narrow passageway, and it can possibly charge tolls for powers to go through this, using this as a trade conduit. And that could mean that it actually could gain hundreds of billions of dollars over the next several years to build up this military that we have allegedly obliterated.
What was the United States trying to accomplish with this?
I mean, every administration really since Carter's has wished to see the end of the radical Shia regime in Iran. This is arguably one of the world's worst and most evil regimes. The world would be better off without it. And it has been the leading exporter of terrorism and has brought misery to many parts of the world. However, again, hundreds, if not thousands, of military war games have gone into this and have concluded that it is too difficult militarily to take the Strait of Hormuz, particularly in an era of you know, one-way suicide drone warfare. The military has been very resistant to the idea that it would actually put the number of boots on the ground needed to maintain control of either Karg Island, which is the central area of oil production for Iran, or the Strait of Hormuz. We were talking about 500,000 men who would be sitting ducks. It would be a turkey shoot, frankly, because we are not able to defend against this kind of drone warfare. Ukraine is actually much more advanced than we are in being able to counter that kind of new battlefield technology. So since an occupation
that's
wasn't
crazy,
really
by the
a possibility,
way.
It is kind of crazy. Yeah. I mean, also crazy when you think about it, is that we have probably exhausted several years worth of our critical battlefield weaponry in terms of missiles and tomahawks and the rest of this, which
and defense missiles.
Also, at the same time, makes us less credible when it comes to standing up to whatever China might want to do with regard to Taiwan. So we're seeing a real situation where the United States is actually being exposed because of its bad governance and Donald Trump's chaotic penchant for decision-making, also his habit of treating allies as enemies and enemies as friends. So it's really not a good moment in our history, frankly.
No, and you know, you hear it's interesting, too, because you hear Defense Secretary Hegseth talk about how, oh, we have, you know, so many more missiles and we're good, we can fight this forever. And it's very clearly we can't.
You know, the optimistic way to look at this is that in what follows the Trump administration, the United States is going to think seriously about how to rebuild its defense industrial capabilities. Yeah. And it will also take more seriously the loss of trust that our allies have had in us. It'll try to turn that around. The problem is that there's an old diplomatic saying, which is that trust is earned in drops and lost in buckets. And we've lost a lot over the last, you know, several months of this Trump administration, beginning with his threat to take over Canada and make it our 51st state, his threat to invade a NATO ally in Denmark and take Greenland from them. This is not the kind of behavior that the United States has ever engaged in since the end of World War II, when we assumed, in effect, leadership of the global order. We are now the leading disruptor of that order rather than its maintainer and protector.
Yeah, and I do really want to get into that in the third segment here, because I want to, what we have disrupted is over 80 years of, you know, allies and friendships and trade norms, and it just, the damage that's been done over just the last couple of months has been staggering. We got Jeff Cabaservice here, VP from the Niskanen Center in Washington, D.C. We're going to keep talking about this right after this on the Rational Revolution, right here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Stick around.
All right.
You're listening to Civic Media. Stay up to date on the latest news and information for your local community and Wisconsin by signing up for our free email newsletter. Visit civicmedia.us/email to get started.
Continue with Rational Revolution on the Civic Media Spotlight with Mark Becker. Mark continues his conversation with Goff Cabaservice, the VP at the Niskanen Center. Make much sense.
So Foo Fighters here for you guys. Mark Becker here in the Rational Revolution. We're sitting down with returning friend Jeff Cabaservice from the Niskanen Center. And we're talking about Iran. And what you know, we're talking about what they're trying to accomplish and all that. What are everyday Iranians experiencing right now?
Awfully hard to say. I have not been to Iran myself. It is not one of the countries that I've been to. I've known a number of people who are part of the Persian diaspora. There's actually a part of Los Angeles called Tehrangeles.
Yes, yes.
So populated with people who once upon a time came from that part of the world.
It's a huge country. People don't realize that. It's a big, 90 million people.
It's five times the size of Iraq. And look at the difficulties we had the last time we thought about trying to turn that country into something more friendly toward us. I think there's been very little appreciation on the part of this administration for the practical difficulties involved in what kind of a military operation against this. Like I said at the outset, you know, I have the greatest respect for our military and our troops. I rejoice that we have mostly managed to keep them out of harm's way, that we managed to recover both of those pilots from the F-16 that Iran managed to shoot down. It's been a wonderful performance and, frankly, in some ways, heartening to see that Iran's Russia and China supplied air defenses have actually proved largely ineffective against our military. But again, the fact that the United States has the world's most powerful military does not mean that we are all powerful. And even at a time in the wake of World War II, when we were, you know, unarguably the world's greatest military power by a long shot, because so much of the world was just prostrate after the destruction of World War II. Even then, at a moment of relatively greater power, we understood that we needed allies, that we simply were incapable of maintaining the kind of global order we wanted to see without assistance and cooperation with our friends. And that memory has been lost with the loss, I think, of the generation that actually remembered World War II. And we're now seeing what happens when you forget the lessons of history.
Yeah, it's wild. And I think, you know, this week, President Trump put out, I think, probably one of the most incendiary statements that an American president has ever done, threatening to kill an entire civilization of people. Could this spiral into something much more dangerous, a regional conflict with other people that are involved? I mean, we're you know, and it's just all, you know, thinking, because they're potentially going to be meeting in Pakistan and we're for peace talks, but then we're also lobbing missiles at each other, and oh my god.
You know, I think it's worth remembering here that there could have been much worse outcomes than what we've seen so far.
Yeah,
not just in terms of loss of our troops, but in terms of a regional conflagration that so far has not broken out on the scale that it could have. But, you know, Donald Trump's statement, condemned by the Pope, among others, you know, really did suggest the possibility of nuclear war. And this, again, this kind of global saber rattling in pursuit of an absolutely incoherent plan, alarms the rest of the world and makes us seem unfit for global leadership. And it also makes China seem, by comparison, the moderate and stable global power. And you're starting to see, you know, real world effects of this, in that China is being credited for brokering this peace along with Pakistan, and increasing numbers of citizens in countries that historically have been among our greatest allies are now saying that they trust China more than they trust us. And this is really something I did not expect to see in my lifetime.
No, me neither. And there was, you know, I forget who, what interview I saw of a podcast that, you know, an ex-ambassador was talking about how since COVID, China has really opened up to the entire rest of the world to both try to bolster its leadership standing on the world stage, but then also kind of rebrand itself as the new up and coming for tech and for innovation and for all the, you know, for where businesses should be. And yeah, if they're taking credit for brokering whatever peace deal that is here, that's dangerous stuff, really.
Yeah, well, we're certainly giving them the ammunition they need to make their case. And, you know, I think that we are in something very much resembling a Cold War with China. Hopefully it never becomes a shooting war. But, you know, the fact is that they believe that they are on a path to global predominance because they plan to master the forthcoming suite of technologies around artificial intelligence. Mm. And they think this will give them the kind of dominant position that was enjoyed by the by Great Britain around the Industrial Revolution and those technologies that Britain was the first to gain mastery over. So, yeah, it's a possible inflection point in world history. And I do not believe that a world dominated by the Chinese would be a better world than one in which we are the dominant power.
Oh, my God. No, I don't think that would be at all. That would no. Yeah. And to think that would happen in our lifetimes is beyond the pale, man. Like, I don't know. It's that's something, you know, you think of back in learning history class in high school and all this, like to think of the United States is not the global leader in power, and the president is not the leader of the free world. It's something that I it's not good. It's not good at all.
Not good. Not good. I mean, you know, to some extent, we're spinning out bad case scenarios here, maybe not worst case scenarios. Yeah. And it's possible that this country can recover from the damage that's been done in this last year of Donald Trump. But, you know, we've still got to get 2.5 years of, through 2.5 years of Trump. And who knows what's going to happen over the course of this time.
Right. And we're going to talk about that in our next segment with Jeff Kebaservice here from the Discanon Center. We're going to talk about how do we regain our position on the world stage and what has to happen in order for us to get there. And is this the worst case scenario, which is glad to say that it's not. We'll finish that discussion here with Jeff Kebaservice coming up next here on the Rational Revolution on the Civic Media Radio Network. Stick around.
Next on the Civic Media Spotlight, we have Native Roots Radio with Robert Pilot. Joining Robert Pilot on Native Roots is Wendy Pilot. She gives us recent updates on the visiting artist Fraser Sundown from Oneida Nation.
They're going to become more repressive because it's a matter of dollars and their illusionary concepts of power.
Hey, Victor.
We must live in balance with the earth.
And also with recent happenings at Wounded Knee.
I am awake.
Welcome to Native Roots Radio Presents. I'm awake, and I'm your host, Wakunja Hade. A karagi to all my friends and relatives in four directions. You are listening to Native Roots Radio Presents. I'm awake, and I'm your host, Robert Pilot. Hey, we discuss local, national, Native news and events. And as you know, Native issues are human issues, and human issues are Native issues. Hey, tonight we got a powerful show lined up. Wendy's going to give us a quick update on what's happening with this coming up week and really give a shout out. And then we also have our friend, visiting artist Fraser Sundown of Oneida Nation. And we're going to be talking about a hands-on session of traditional corn husk twining. And then plus we're going to be talking to Red Lake Nation College and a lot going on there. And we're going to be spotlighting them. Well, Wendy, let's start off with you again. Big Pinigigi, thank you so much for coming on. And there's a lot going on with the sacred animal portion of our show right now, Wen.
Yeah, there is. So yesterday, everyone, I was updating you about going to Rid Glen Farms in Blue Mounds, Wisconsin, where they house over 2,000 beagles, and they use the beagles for breeding and for experimentation. The dogs are... the place is set to close on July 1st due to over 300 violations. Many of the violations are for animal cruelty. Last month, there were a group of people who went and broke in and got some dogs out. They got 30 dogs out. 8 of them were confiscated from the police, the sheriff's department there. We're going back on April 19th. This is a nonviolent open rescue. We want everyone to know about it. We want the governor of Wisconsin, Tony Evers, to know about this. We want the sheriff to know about this. We want the city council to know about this. And we want all the residents of Wisconsin to know about this and be aware of this. And we will be going back on April 19th. There's over 1,700 people signed up to go to this facility. Again, nonviolent. We want to get the rest of the dogs out. And yesterday I put in for an ask because this costs money. You know, many of us are lodging there, food, gas, travel. Plus, we need stuff for the dogs, right? We need potty pads, and we need blankets and beds. We need slip leads. We need blankets, harnesses, leashes. We also need treats and toys, too. So we need a lot of supplies to do this. And I put an ask out yesterday and asked for donations to help. And I just want to thank the people tonight so much who did this. I'm just going to say their first and last initial. First of all, Maureen H., you know who you are. We know you for a long time. Yeah, everyone was so generous. I really just want to thank everybody. So Maureen H., Jada F., Susan P., Claire W., and Jeannie O. There's other people who wrote me messages saying that they're going to send me checks, and I really, really appreciate that. Teresa N. and Paul S. So I want to thank all of you for, you know, your donations. This money's going to go far, and no penny of it will go waste, you know, go wasted. Even if I get all the money I need for what I'm doing, I will donate the money to others. I mean, there's 1,700 of us. A lot of people are flying in. My roommate, who I don't even know yet, who is going to stay at the hotel, is flying in from Hawaii, and she's doing this with us. So there's people coming from South Carolina, California, Arizona. I mean, people are coming from all over the United States to come and help with this rescue. And we're just so excited. And we just want these dogs to go to good homes. So you could go on savethedog.io. The website will come up. You could volunteer to help be there in Wisconsin with us. Or if you can't, you could donate there as well. You could also sign up for an adoption. If you want to adopt one of these dogs or foster one of these dogs, you could fill out an application. So we're really, you know, we're nervous about this, but we're also excited. I think most of us, I know for me, I just kind of keep the dog at the forefront. And I just think about that dog, and I want to take that dog out of that horrible environment where this dog is literally being tortured every day, take it out and put it in a good home, you know, let it sleep in a nice warm bed and have a blanket and a toy and be somebody's companion animal. That's where, you know, what I feel is where it should be.
Well, Wendy, you know, I just want to say a big peeny geegee thank you always for talking about our relatives, you know, our sacred animals every, you know, when you come on. And this is really important, you know, and in the Native community, dogs are sacred. You know, we have a lot of chiefs and Crow Dog and people that are named after them. You see the old pictures of people in front of their teepee or chipotle or wigwam, and there's a big old dog there. So we think this is really important. And again, Wendy's Venmo is Wendy or at Wendy Pilot. And
It's at Wendy Dash Pilot.
Yeah. And again, a big peeny geegee. Thank you, everybody, for supporting us and supporting Wendy on this journey.
I just want to say one other thing. If you want to, you can call the Dane County, Wisconsin Sheriff's Department and tell them that you're in support of Rigland, you know, surrendering the dogs. Today, I called Governor Tony Evers. And he's always been a great supporter of what we're doing. He's on the radio show here quite often and gives updates. And I talked to his legislative assistant today. I had a really nice conversation with her. And she was kind of aware of what was going on. Like, she heard about this, what was going on. And she thinks that, you know, Governor Evers is aware of this. And my ask to Governor Evers is to talk to Rigland Farms and plead with them and convince them that the right thing to do would be surrendering these dogs to us and not sell them to other labs. Mm-hmm. So, you know, but unfortunately, you know, where the mighty, mighty dollar lies is, you know.
Well, Mark, one of the big legislators out of that's on Tom Arnold once a week, or Tom Hartman, thank you, on AM 950 and Across the Nation, has Pocan on, and he he wrote a big kind of a public response to this organization.
Yes, so he is in support. I'll just read the last sentence of his letter. So Mark Pocan, who is the United States House Representatives, wrote a letter in response to Rigland Farms' email that they sent. Rigland Farms wrote, you know, that these animal rights extremists are coming and I need your help.
Oh, wow. Hey, I like that hat for me. Just people that are watching us on social media, he's got a really cool hat that I might have to look into. Oh, wow. That's nice. So can you talk a little bit about what's going to be going on at the Walker Art Center at 6 p.m. on the 9th?
Sure, yeah. Rosie Simas invited me over there to share the techniques of what we call corn husk twining. And so that's ancient corn husk weaving that Haudenosaunee people have done throughout our history of our people. And I'm just here to revitalize that and bring it back to life, because it kind of died off a little bit there.
Well, I there's a picture of it on the website and it's beautiful. It's just amazing. So how long have you been working on these? And this is a beautiful thing, and it really, and is it just to Oneida, or what other tribes use the corn husking method?
From what I studied, it was mostly used by the Haudenosaunee people, like all of the Six Nations. Majority of the work that you can find is mostly throughout the Seneca people. And so that's where I picked up this form of art. I've been working with corn husks for almost 20 years now, and I picked up twining over that duration. And that's where I picked it up, as within the Seneca people. And a lot of the objects from our history, they still exist today. Some of the ceremonial objects and things. And yeah.
Well, it's amazing too. My notes here says that they also weave bottles, and not only moccasins, but bottles and other items like baskets. And I know Ho-Chunk are really big into weaving baskets, but I don't think it's with corn husks.
Yeah, there's a lot of different fibers that are used in other nations. They do the same technique as weaving. I'm kind of envious of those other fibers, because they're a lot longer than corn husk. So it would be a lot easier to do. But when it comes to corn husk, you're only working with a limited length of fibers that you have. And so it's a little bit, I could see that it would be a little bit more difficult. But it does, you know, bring us to where we're from, you know, the people of the Haudenosaunee, we are corn people. So we would definitely use that fiber. And I would think that would be the same thing for the other nations that do the types of weaving, or the same thing, the twining with their fibers.
Well, with the corn husk, you said it's only so long. So my big size 11, 12s wouldn't fit in there. Oh, just kidding. Yeah. So, you know, so can you tell us a little bit, like, how would you start? Is it twining? It kind of looked like, and I don't have the picture in front of me, but it kind of looked like almost braiding at first.
Yeah, it's a little bit
you have the sort of concepts of using those muscles in your hands to braid, as you know, you're clamping down with your fingers and you're weaving, and when you could start multiple ways, but the way that bottles, for instance, or moccasins are started, there's a nucleus that you build in the beginning by folding corn husk and then sort of like conjoining them together, and they sort of like clamp in together, and then you sort of create this wheel, and the spokes, you get into those basket terms when you, as you get further along with twining, and then you have your own, I kind of made up my own terms there. You have your twiner and then you have your spokes. And so when you're twining sort of in the, in a circular, I guess direction, and you know, you could create those bottles, or I created, because that was something that our people used in our history, was bottles, and they used to store salt in them for many things.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
For the last segment of the Civic Media Spotlight, we stick with Native Roots Radio with Robert Pilot.
Well, let's talk about this again. So it's going to be two sessions I'm reading here, one at 6 and one at 7:30, and you're going to be teaching people how to use the corn husk in twine to make things like moccasins. And this is going to be at the Walker Art, April 9th, 2026 at 6 p.m. at the Cargill Lounge, which is a beautiful lounge at the Walker.
Oh, yeah. I can't wait to see it. It's going to be exciting.
So what do people need to bring other than a good attitude and patience? Oh, wow.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I got to bring some patience because, you know, it gets real tough. And throughout all of my other workshops, I've seen people get a little frustrated. But it teaches you a lot of patience. And it's very therapeutic when you do it. So, yeah, that good energy is definitely needed there.
So the corn husking is really, I'm reading here too, is twining is central to the gallery presentation, and materials will be provided and distributed. First comes, first serve. So everybody get out there early and get ready to do that, because that sounds really, really exciting. Fraser, do you have anything else you want people to know about this great activity?
Yeah, just that, you know, just really raising that awareness that it needs to be brought back to life. We need to revitalize this. This is something that's dying off within our people. And so, you know, by bringing that alive and keeping that going, you're also bringing alive a lot of other things that come along with it, because you're sitting there face to face with each other and keeping alive a lot of the traditions that our ancestors carried forth, you know, and want us to do the same.
And I know, you know, when we do things this like this in a community, there's also just natural storytelling going on. Do you, Fraser, talk about the history and things like that? What do you say during this activity?
Oh, yes, definitely. I'm going to be bringing some information and some photos that I have of twining and objects that our people do, and I will most definitely be relaying the history that I've studied about twining, cornhusk twining specifically.
So when people go and aren't able to finish their product, is there a YouTube video or videos out there that you have show how to do this, or is this pretty much person to person?
There was a YouTube video. It's not there anymore. There is some. If you search, there is some videos that are out there. I know I have a short one that sort of gives a little bit of an intro to how to twine. There's not too much explaining in that, but if you go to the workshop and you sit and listen to the skills, you could definitely get it if you want to pursue that and keep going. I would hope that's what I would get out of this workshop, is for students to definitely keep progressing on more projects or finish the project that they're going to be doing.
Yeah. You know, we only got a minute left here, and I really appreciate you coming on, Fraser, and talking about this event coming up on April 9th at 6 p.m. at the Walker. You know, it's so cool to see a lot of things that we do and work on that is art, but it also is really things that we use in our daily life. And I just want to say a big peeny geeky, Fraser, for doing this and keeping this alive. This is a huge deal for our community, and I really appreciate that, Fraser.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Y'all go. To you as well, and I really appreciate the words and this time here that we took to relay this message and talk about this thing.
Yes, one more time at the Walker Thursday, April 9th at 6 p.m. at the Cargill Lounge. It is free, and it is a beautiful thing, and Rosie is always cutting edge on things, and so I appreciate what's going on here and what's happening, and it'll be a great thing. And I just want to get the word out as much as possible. This has just been awesome. Okay. He gave me, people listening on the radio, he gave me the okay sign with the two fingers.
Yeah.
Right on, Fraser. Thanks for coming on, man. And I'll see you soon, and the great work, and keep up the good work. Going to talk about a few things like Future Fest and career and transfer fair, and I want to introduce Nadine Bell, Sarah Butler, and Donna Council. Thank you, Big Peeny Geeky. Thank you to our three for being on. It's my honor to have you on, and I love your college. I've been there quite a few times for events, and it's just a great place. So I'd really like to start out with Nadine and talk about informer the listeners about the college and all the great things that are happening there. Welcome to Native Roots Radio.
Great. All right. Thank you, Robert. Just making sure you can hear. Yes. thank you for having us today. We're really excited to share not only information about the college, but an exciting event that we have coming up on April 14th. One of our main taglines at Red Lake Nation College is that we're a great place to start. Our main campus is up on the Red Lake Reservation in Red Lake. We have 414 students this last year.
Wow.
We've grown exponentially over the last couple of years, and we're really excited. We're one of the youngest TCUs in the country. As you know, there's 38 tribal colleges across the country that represent the vast majority of tribes. And we're really excited. We have 15 different tribes that are represented in our student body this year. About half of those students attend through distance education.
That was cool. Hey, up next, we got Red Lake Nation College, and we're going to be talking about some things there. And you are listening to Native Roots Radio. We'll be right back after this short break. Please stay with us. Ho-wah.
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.